From Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading writers and directors. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. On today's episode, Thelma and Louise screenwriter and Nashville showrunner, Callie Curry.
With Thelma and Louise, I was called to it. That was the greatest experience writing I've ever had.
Masters of Sex showrunner, Michelle Ashford.
The idea of when I read that book and realized what they were actually up to in those exam rooms, first of all, that would be radical now. And so that, to me, was the appeal of it.
And Edward Scissorhands screenwriter Caroline Thompson.
Our original belief was that this was so odd that maybe if we made it as a musical, people could accept it. So in addition to writing the prose version, I wrote these really terrible lyrics. And, you know, like, you know, I can't handle it, things like that, you know.
On Story will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. Filmmaker Callie Curry won the Academy Award in 1992 for her first screenplay, Thelma and Louise. The film, starring Susan Sarandon and Gina Davis in the title roles, was directed by Ridley Scott and included performances by Harvey Keitel, Michael Madsen, and Brad Pitt in one of his earliest appearances on the big screen. Thelma and Louise was once considered controversial for its feminist overtones, but has since achieved classic status, even inspiring songs by Tori Amos, Me and a Gun, and Argentinian Fito Páez, Dos Días en la Vida, as well as countless parodies of its final scene on television and even video games. Callie Curry's other films include Something to Talk About, Divine Secrets of the Ya-Ya Sisterhood, and the series Nashville. Screenwriter and Nerdist contributor Ben Blacker spoke with Callie Curry in 2013 at the 20th Austin Film Festival.
I was born in Texas, born in San Antonio, and my dad got out of the Army and we moved to Kentucky. I mean, he died when I was very young, but if he were still here, I'd be haranguing him about it endlessly because I should have grown up in New York City. I think I could have done so much more if I had been in a place where I knew that anything was going on at all.
It's not too late to make something of yourself.
I know. I know, but I really got a late start. I am really, honestly, a late bloomer. I remember we had two movie theaters in our town, and my mom would just drop us off there on a Saturday. And one day she dropped us off for an Alfred Hitchcock movie, Frenzy. And I was like 8 years old. Like sitting there and just being like, this is totally inappropriate. I started reading like Joseph Heller when I was 11 or something, you know, Charles Dickens, you know, all the Sherlock Holmes books, all of Jane Austen. Anything I could get my hands on, honestly, because I just needed stimulation.
Do you remember in reading this stuff or in seeing these films when you became aware that someone wrote these, that there was an author to these things and that might be something you could do?
When you would read something like by Bud Schulberg or one of those, you know, or Tennessee Williams or any piece of work that had the indelible imprint of the author and not the director so much. Mm-hmm. I mean, even though those films that they did were obviously made by great directors, but you felt like you were hearing the voice of an author. That really stuck with me, but it was never something that I thought I could do. Mm-hmm. Well, I had started doing plays when I was in high school, because after my dad died, it was so hard to be home at night without him in the house. So rehearsal went till like 10 o'clock. It was great. It was a lot of fun and kind of brought out the ham bone in me. And I really loved drama and I loved comedy too. I mean, but it was just this aspect of myself that I had never even considered. So yeah, I switched my major to drama at like one of the biggest ag and engineering schools in the Midwest. Genius. I could have moved to IU that had a great theater department, but that would have taken, you know, some self-starter genes that were dormant at the time. the Guthrie Theater was in Chicago, and they would send people down, and we would get to do kind of master class stuff. And I did get put in the graduate program as a freshman. And the Juilliard Company came. It was when Patti LuPone and Kevin Klein were madly in love, and they would just be wrapped around each other, making out the entire time. And then they would go out on stage, and they were doing The Robber Bridegroom and A Midsummer Night's Dream, and unbelievable. It was so great. I had no idea that theater could be that great. I think up until that time, I'd probably seen Up with People, and that was it. I mean, I had no... And Damn Yankees that I was in, and Little Mary Sunshine. And I was Little Mary Sunshine.
And what was it? I mean, you've obviously worked with actors for a number of years now. What was it you saw in that performance that was transformative or transporting?
They were completely characters. You saw none of the work. You only saw the characters. You know, their understanding of every single word that was coming out of their mouth, the nuance, everything. It was just absolutely stunning.
How do you take that to the next level? How do you become more than just a competent amateur?
I think there is a part of it that it has to be somehow more than you. You know what I mean? It's not just you. I honestly and unfortunately believe that at some point, some other thing has to be summoned that comes from outside you or inside you. I'm not sure how it gets there, but when you're writing at a higher level than you feel like you would inhabit, there's something else at work there. You almost have to call it or, you know, conjure it or something. With Thelma and Louise, I was called to it. Mm-hmm. That was the greatest experience writing I've ever had. And I don't expect that I'll ever have that again.
Why do you think it was?
Well, because I'd never written anything. So I had nothing on the line. Mm-hmm. I had nothing to lose. And my only goal was to finish it. I didn't tell people I was going to write it. It's so easy to get discouraged, and it's so easy to be made fun of, especially when you're living in LA, which I was. To tell somebody that you're writing a screenplay, they just, you know, they just scoff. Like, and I just knew that if I got even a drop of discouragement, it would be enough to stop me. So I didn't share widely that I was doing it. By that time, I was working in production, and I had this crazy thing happen where I got this idea and I felt like something had come to me and I had this responsibility to kind of get it on paper. It was like the whole thing came at once, the whole feeling of the movie. What people, I hope, left the theater feeling, that's how the movie came to me. It was like getting punched in the heart. I'll never forget waking up in the middle of the night. I wrote the scene where Thelma has to call Daryl to find out what he knows. And she's saying, if he says anything at all, just hang up. I literally woke up in the middle of the night, wrote that scene. He knows, click, went back to sleep. And that doesn't happen to me, unfortunately. That's not to say I didn't have hours and hours where I would sit there and try to think of, because I knew where the story was going at the end, but I wasn't sure of how I was getting there. I didn't outline it. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't know each scene. So each time I sat down, I just knew I had to progress the story. And I knew nothing about screenwriting. I didn't read any books. I remember I was in a bookstore one day and I picked up a Sid Field book and I opened it and there was a diagram and I was like, oh, math. And I was like, I closed it. I didn't. And I knew if I started like trying to learn rules or whatever, there were any kind of limits or anything that somebody said, I wasn't going to be able to do it.
What was there when the lightning bolt first struck?
Two women go on a crime spree. That's the line that came, two women go on a crime spree. And I knew that it was two average women who were not criminals, who were only outlaws in that the society that we were asked to live in was so insane that you could not help but break the law. And so I'd never written anything before, and I had no idea how to do it. And I was producing music videos. I was watching people get stuff made that I was just like, are you kidding me? That clown got somebody to give him money to make a movie? Are you kidding me? You know? So I thought, why can't I be that clown? You know? I just wanted to see if I could finish it, because up until then, that had been my biggest problem, is ever finishing anything. And beyond that, I had no idea what would happen.
How long did it all take to get down?
6 months. I thought about it for about 4 months before I started writing. I literally just sat there and would think, okay, what are their jobs? And like when I first started thinking of Louise, you know, I started thinking of her as this woman who no one can see. You know, like when I first started thinking of her, she was like, she's one of those women that wears makeup in such a way that you can't really tell what her face looks like. You know what I mean? It's like they have these faces that go on over their face that completely changes it. You have no idea what their real face looks like. And that was so fascinating to me because to me that is like a perfect, it's like the woman mask. It's a way of absolutely hiding who you are. People judge you about that too, you know, or they assign things to you that don't have anything to do with you. And so the whole idea of Louise was like that to me. She's like one of those people, she works at, you know, when you walk into huge office buildings like in Dallas or any big city, and there's people sitting at the front desk and they direct you to which offices to go to, and you have no idea, but they're like in operations or something like that. You have no idea what their life is, no idea, but they're there to present a very specific kind of face and not give you any personality or anything. That's how I started thinking of her, only because I knew that she was going to be in hiding. Anyway, I just let the ideas marinate until I knew who both of them were.
Well, let's talk about Thelma too.
You know, that was a woman that I also felt like, you know, I'd had some really funny and horrible jobs when I was in college. Like I wrapped meat at Kroger and stuff like that. And, you know, I just had like these windows into, even though I grew up in a small town, like I was a country club kid, you know, and I saw all the wives and, you know, what they did with their days and what they thought was important. And I felt like there was this kind of thing. It was like you were expected to be less than you were. And you were expected to be happy about it. Like that was supposed to somehow be success. And it just never seemed like that to me. I wanted Thelma to have not so many options. You know what I mean? Like she was just doing what was expected of her, which was she would get married and probably have kids. And for whatever reason, they hadn't gotten around to that. And her husband was the king of his tiny little castle. You know, she went about her day trying to figure out what it was he wanted, you know, without really ever thinking of herself very much. I wanted women that I could love, that if I met them, I felt like I knew them or would be friends with them and could love them, even though they were both from a slightly lower social strata than the one I grew up in, given the fact that I was prepared to do absolutely nothing with my life that could bring me any money. These were the people I was going to be working with unless I married somebody rich. You know what I mean? I had not prepared myself, in other words, to become a professional. I wasn't going to be a doctor. I wasn't going to be, you know, I wasn't a business major. I hadn't done any of that stuff. These were the kind of women that I was going to know in my working life. I was going to be a waitress, which I was, you know, I did a lot of that. And I'm so glad I did, by the way, because, you know, again, the exposure is so important, not just to the people you work with, but, you know, when you're doing a job like that, you're certainly in touch with the public every day. And so you get to meet or come in contact with all different kinds of people in a very specific way. And you get to really, really look at people. I needed to put them in a place where, one, they weren't going to have the power of money to get them out of anything, that money was going to be an issue because money was an issue for me and a powerlessness that comes along with that, that cannot be denied. And really, really, it's a reality for millions and millions and millions of women that they don't have access to the money. Mm-hmm. And that's a big deal. I mean, money is power. There's no getting around it.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International will be back in a moment with more of Academy Award-winning screenwriter Callie Khouri. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. We're back with Academy Award-winning screenwriter Callie Khoury speaking with Ben Blacker at the 20th Austin Film Festival.
So about 6 months to write this screenplay. And how did you feel when you were done with it?
It's funny. I was euphoric on the one hand because I loved it so much. And I was completely sanguine on the other hand, going, nothing's ever going to happen with this. I'm going to try to get somebody to give me money and I'm going to make it. And I don't know how many years it's going to take me, but I'm going to make this movie.
And was it called Thelma and Louise?
Yes, it was, because I couldn't think of another title. I thought somebody that knows what they're doing will come up with a great title for this.
When did you feel like you could start showing it to people?
Well, I showed it to my friend that I had been producing with, Amanda Temple. Her husband was a director, Julian Temple, who did, you know, he did that movie Absolute Beginners, and he was wonderful, Earth Girls Are Easy, and fabulous director, really, really great, and made incredible music videos. And so I let Amanda read it, and she flipped out, you know. She thought it was brilliant, and some point along the way, she said, I want to give it to my friend Mimi Polk. She works for Ridley Scott, but they get a lot of foreign financing. And so she might be able to set us on to someone who could give us some money. And then Mimi called and was like, I'd really love to let Ridley read this. And I was like, oh, no. It's like, dream's over. You know, he's going to read it and just go, what? No. But that did not happen.
How much does the film that we know resemble your
It's draft? Incredibly close.
Really?
Yeah. I was really, really lucky.
Yeah.
I was lucky in the casting, for one thing. The tone of the movie is really tough, you know? Yeah. I mean, it's not an easy tone to pull off because it has to be incredibly serious and funny and all these different things at once. And so it's not easy.
Yeah.
And I just didn't think it was something that just anybody was going to be able to do, that it was going to take a certain type of actress to do it.
Did you worry
two
about
two of
that?
Which I got.
Yeah, no kidding. Really got lucky on that. Did you worry about capturing that tone, handing it over to a different director?
We talked about it endlessly.
I would imagine.
You know, and he questioned me on a lot of it. He was like, how do you think this is going to work? Mm-hmm. Like, they've just shot this guy. They're sitting in this coffee shop. She's crying. She breaks the cup. And they get in this fight. Is that supposed to be funny? And I said, yeah. And he was like, are you sure? And I was like, yeah, it'll work. You know, I mean, I just, because I could see it so clearly, I knew it was a compelling story that I was telling. And I was having fun telling it in a way that was unexpected. You know, that's the thing, is that you want to surprise people. And I felt like that certainly did do that.
Let's talk briefly about what happened after Thelma and Louise.
For a long time, all that would come to me were like the kind of movies that I didn't really, I would go, why are they offering me this? This was nothing. Thelma and Louise, that was a hard movie. That wasn't like sweet. Mm-hmm. You know, I would get offered stuff that I thought was super girly. You know, I would just be like, why are they asking me for this? Did they not see the movie? It's like, I realized, oh, well, there were two women. Here's two women. Do that, you know? Here's four women. Can you do that, you know? And it was like, everything I got was women, women, women. And I got to the point where I was like, I think I've pretty much said everything on the subject of women I've had to say. You know, I've got that pretty well covered, you know? I don't know what else there is to talk about. Mm-hmm. Divine Secrets of the Ya-Ya Sisterhood comes to me, and I was literally like, you've got to be kidding me. No. I said no when they offered me the book. I was like, this is exactly what I don't want to do. Mm-hmm. I read the book. I was driving through Utah with my then husband, and I remember I finished the book. I rolled down the window, and I, who hate littering more than anything, I threw the book out the window. I was just like, I can't believe this is what they want me to do. You know what I mean? And I just didn't really see what it was that I uniquely was going to bring to this story. And so I was like, I don't even know how to tell that story. Actually, I was getting on a plane to come here to meet my friend Kath, and we were talking about it. I said, I don't even know really what this is about. I mean, it's about friendships. And she goes, oh, no, I know exactly what it's about. And she starts explaining it to me about, like, it's this relationship this girl has to her mother who has damaged her so completely, and it's she's carrying it with her, and it's totally impeding her whole worldview until her friends come and humanize her mother for her. And in the book, you know, they weren't together. I mean, she was off at a cabin by herself, and everything happened on the phone and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, I just went, oh, okay, I can do that, you know? It's like, immediately, the whole thing became crystal clear.
Did you worry about audience from that? I mean, that was a huge book for many women.
Well, yeah, I mean, I thought about it. You know, I didn't want to do anything that was going to put them off, but certainly having her alone in a cabin by herself and people call her and tell her stories over the phone wasn't going to work, you know? So I had to come up with a device to get them all together and blah, blah, blah. And I was incredible. I mean, come on, I got Sandy Bullock in the movie. Jesus, you know, and then Ashley Judd and then Ellen Burstyn and Maggie Smith and Fionnuala Flanagan and Shirley Knight and James Garner. And, you know, I mean, come on. It was so great. I couldn't believe it.
You must enjoy directing. What do you get from directing that you don't get from writing?
It's just more writing. It's more storytelling. It's just the same thing. I mean, if you're a screenwriter, you have to be coming at it from a pretty visual point of view because we are writing pictures. Mm-hmm. That's what we're doing.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. Screenwriter Michelle Ashford is best known for her work on the 2010 miniseries The Pacific. Her current series, Masters of Sex, is based on Thomas Mayer's biography of legendary sex researchers Dr. William Masters and Virginia Johnson. The Showtime drama set in the 1950s and 60s stars Michael Sheehan and Lizzie Kaplan and has been renewed for a fourth season to air later in 2016. Michelle Ashford spoke with New York Times Magazine contributor Robert Draper on October 24, 2014 at the 21st Austin Film Festival. A word of warning, the next segment may not be appropriate for some of our younger listeners, as it does acknowledge the existence of sex.
I want to talk about the time and the place in which Masters of Sex is situated. It's this moment of sort of post-war primacy, but also a kind of Victorian morality. The place is Middle America, St. Louis. And so what you essentially have done is to write a story about sex cast in a pretty unsexy time and place. And talk about the challenges of doing that.
Well, that was the appeal, actually, was the fact that they met in 1956. And it was a very dormant time. It was very quiet and sexually, you know, not adventurous at all. And so the idea of when I read that book and realized what they were actually up to in those exam rooms, first of all, that would be radical now, honestly, what they were doing. And I thought how bizarre that it was set in such a button-down time. And so that, to me, was the appeal of it. So now we're getting into the 60s. Our second season ends in 1961 with JFK's inaugural speech. And the reason that really appealed to me, and I sort of knew that was an endpoint, was his speech. He says, the torch has been passed to a new generation. And I thought, well, that's very interesting, because they were still underground, and yet their work was getting closer and closer to kind of coming to the surface, as was all the sexual revolutions, civil rights. All this was bubbling more and more to the surface. And the interesting thing about Masters and Johnson is they started so hidden because of the sort of radical nature of their work, and they ended up in their careers on the front of Time magazine. So I thought, well, it starts in a very button-down part of history, and then it kind of comes to the surface in a time when the world was just turned upside down. And not only were they sort of paralleled, starting kind of subterranean, kind of coming into this explosion of societal upheaval, but they were also integral to it, because by the time in 1966, when their book came out, the women's movement was already underway. The pill had already been used widely for birth control, which was, I mean, you can't underestimate what that did to the sexual revolution. And they were sort of part of this revolution as well. So they were both mimicking it, but they were also deeply tied to it. So I thought it was, our show goes from not having much societal awareness to having a hugely intertwined with what was happening in the world at large. We have a strange show in that their careers lasted 30 years. And so to sort of do this story justice, we need to really move. So I can't think of a show quite, and this is a very tough thing for us to figure out. I can't think of a show that has to move through so much history
Isn't there an episode that jumped from 1958 to 1960?
We did. Our first year, because everyone was sort of settling into this show and trying to figure it out, we did sort of a continuous year that took a season, and that feels very normal when you're a viewer, that, okay, I understand sort of where I am. But I realized if we were going to tell the story properly, we were going to have to make some big leaps. So I thought, well, season two will just come back, and we'll be 3 years ahead. And then as we started to discuss it, there was lots of grumbling about this because everyone was saying, well, you've sort of ended it with a cliffhanger. And if you just jump 3 years ahead, everyone's just going to say, well, what happened on that doorstep? Like, well, what was that about? And how is that going to play out? And so we realized that could be very frustrating if you were watching to go, well, like, what happened? Where's all that missing material? So we kind of picked up where we left off. But we still had this problem that we needed to really jump. And so one day I thought, what if you jumped in an episode? What if you saw an episode that just moves through a series of years and you're actually watching it? It was strange, but I thought, I've never actually seen it. I've never actually seen that. And I thought, well, let's just try it. It nearly killed me, that episode. Structurally, it was one of the hardest things I've ever written.
There's a particular episode I wanted to talk to Michelle about. It's episode 3 of season 2. It's called Fight. To me, is really one of the greatest TV episodes I've ever seen, just across the spectrum. And it operates on so many different levels. I mean, it is set almost entirely in a hotel room. And it achieves a kind of almost a claustrophobia at times because you cannot escape the conversation that Virginia and Bill are having. But the context of it is this Archie Moore boxing fight. And to me, one of the remarkable things that the show does is it's the first time we see Bill Masters as a reliable narrator. He's explaining to us something that we think of superficially, a boxing match, and explaining the nuances and how it relates to issues of masculinity and mortality. And talk about how this came to be.
You know, again, we had this character that was strange and sort of unlikable, and in the first season we hinted that he's coming from a very tough backstory, which is all this backstory is true about the real Bill Masters. Michael Sheen, I think one of the things that really fueled his examination of this character is that he knew he was carrying this secret. So actors have many ways of doing their work, but this secret was key to him in terms of how he played scenes, in terms of how he maneuvered through this story. I mean, we hinted at it, so people are smart when they're watching and they can figure out, oh, okay, so he's got some troubling past. But after a while, you want to know. You just want to know. I mean, you have a sense of sort of when people get tired of a show being cagey with stuff. And so I said, we're going to eventually need to really sort of lay this bare, which is scary for him because now that I'm sort of taking away one of the things that he's holding, which is his secret. But I felt like we had put it off long enough so that it felt earned. And the other thing we needed to do is we needed to really cement these two as a couple, that you really needed to invest in them as a pair. We'd been very cagey about it, and I didn't want to, the network, Showtime, really wanted me at the first episode in season two to lay it all out. They're going to a hotel room. This is what they're doing in the hotel room. This is how it's. And I said, but why don't we wait? Why don't we know they're going to a hotel room? Play that for a little bit, and everyone can start to say, but what is happening in that hotel room? And then it was always planned that third episode would be the one that would be only in the hotel room, and you would finally understand what it is that's actually going on with these two. Not to pat myself on the back, but I think it was much better to hold that off for a bit, because then everyone's thinking, well, what is the nature of their relationship, and why do I care about it, more importantly? So to then devote a whole episode to saying, this is why you should care about it, because this is actually what's happening. This is the fabric that actually holds these two together. The fight came about from our research, because, again, we would say, what was happening in the world? And that was the first televised boxing match. And so we thought, oh, that's interesting, because obviously boxing has a lot to do with violence, and we knew Masters' past involved a lot of physical abuse. And so we thought, well, that's really interesting. And then we'd been kicking around this story forever since the first season, which was Masters had performed surgery on a baby that was born with both sexes. That story had been kicking around, was up on a board, and then we found out about the boxing, and then we knew this was going to be in one hotel room, just straight. And all of a sudden, they all sort of came together. And
not obviously, though. I mean, they're all finally about masculinity, but you could have devoted three episodes to each of those three.
Yes, it is. That's true. And you're right. It wasn't obvious because it did take us a long time to figure out exactly how to put that puzzle together. But once it did, it seemed like, for example, people were saying, no, dump the baby. Dump the baby. And I was like, no, don't dump the baby. The baby's actually this weird, first of all, to me, it's the most horrifying film. I mean, I was watching it thinking, I cannot believe we're going to put this out there. Like, we're going to get a letter saying you need social services is going to be at your door in 5 minutes.
Because just for those of you who haven't seen it, it's about this quasi-hermaphroditic baby, maybe, but it's just as much about the baby's father, who cannot bear to have a sexually ambiguous child. Implicit in all of this is a notion about masculinity, but it's you're right, it's horrifying to watch.
Yeah.
It's also Bill Masters, who is this repressed guy, nonetheless, who is suffused with all his own feelings of abuse, and his father passing judgment on him, seeing this father of a newborn child about to do the same thing in the most garish and most physical of ways.
Yes, well, what we wanted is this father who was, and by the way, that was a sort of a matter of course, that if you had a baby that was sexually ambiguous, is a very, very complicated thing determining when a situation like that happens, determining what the baby should actually be. So, but that wasn't, the time was not taken then. So yes, so we wanted the father who was massively uncomfortable with this ambiguity to be a mirror of Master's own father, who, you know, was an extremely tough and complicated man, to provoke in Master's that feeling of, oh my God, I'm back in this situation with a horrific bully, and to see him as an adult have all that stirred up, which then allows him to talk about that more freely in that hotel room.
Well, and the cruelty of this episode is that when you finally break from the claustrophobia of this hotel room, it's to the hospital where you see this awful stuff happening. And so, if anything, you want to scurry back to the hotel room where this interesting and in no way linear dialogue is taking place. And to me, the episode achieves this kind of meta quality because we're learning about Bill Masters through his past. We're learning that through Lizzie, who's learning about it through the first time. And she's really learning about it because it's prompted by this TV show, by a boxing match. And so everything is indirect. And I wonder if you know, were seeing this opportunity to discover Bill Masters through this boxing match, where it's sort of described that, no, it's not just about simply trading punches. It's about, you know, what you show the other, the other boxer. And this is, of course, Bill talking about himself as a child and what you show your father, that you can take this abuse. And though you knew, of course, the historical backstory to Bill Masters and saw this as an opportunity, while you were thinking about this Archie Moore first televised ever boxing match, starting to see the way of describing boxing as a way to describe being a young male victim, right?
I think before Masters died, he was working on an autobiography. In that book, and it is one of the more chilling things, he talks about this past with his father, and that his father had said to him, these beatings will stop when you get on your knees and you beg me to stop. And one of the things that I think completely defines the man was that he knew he would never concede to that. It was a matter of pride and self-preservation and who he was. But as a result, I mean, and this is happening as a child, so you can imagine, as a result, that made him an incredibly guarded and sort of inaccessible man, because he grew up thinking, I will show no weakness, I will not show vulnerability, I will not do it. It became a matter of survival for him.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International, we'll be back in a moment with more of Masters of Sex showrunner Michelle Ashford and Edward Scissorhands screenwriter Caroline Thompson later in our program. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. We're back with Masters of Sex showrunner Michelle Ashford speaking with journalist Robert Draper at the 21st Austin Film Festival.
Clearly, you suffused them with all this humanity while still making them very true to their rigid selves. And again, was this something you saw as a challenge and even a delight to sort of work with?
Well, it's a curious thing. I think that we're being very true to the man. The man was very repressed, did not have social skills. I mean, he picked her as his partner because he really knew where his weaknesses were. She was warm and socially engaging and put people at ease. He was the opposite. So even though it might seem a little bit like a trope, it's actually true to who they were.
Right.
He was really repressed and a strange man. He had an incredible instinct for knowing that she was the only way that he was going to be able to do this work. I mean, that by himself, he was just too weird, and that the strangeness of the study and then with him alone everyone would just go, you're just too weird, we're not doing this. So she was the catalyst for making people feel comfortable. One of the things she did, which was so incredible, if you think that this was the late 50s, is she would go to women. She had this charmingly predator sort of quality. She would like find women and she would sort of just charm them into doing this work, which when you think about it was, you know, asking someone to go into an exam room, get naked, get wired up, have sex. It was a really strange proposition. And what she would do is she would say to women, you are changing the world. I mean, they got really excited, like they felt they were just going to be, you know, part of some new wave and championing women and you know, scientific pioneers. And they got all fired up about it. But that was because she made them feel like this was important and not sleazy, but significant work. And he was not capable of doing that. I think one of the reasons we feel okay about doing this, and you just have to hope that people hang in there with you, is the true trajectory of that character was he changed radically in this 30-year period with her. She also changed and sort of went more his direction.
Right. You're saying that there are all these layers. Makes me wonder if you're still hiding the ball on other aspects, both of Bill or Virginia. Are there other aspects of the past that you've been holding back on that we're likely to see manifested?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, one of the things that I can say about that is that in that episode, she tells a backstory about a captain who she fell in love with, who broke her heart, and that she decided from then on she was going to separate sex and love. And in fact, when the real woman was presenting this story to Tom, she sort of told it in this way, which was like, you know, because one of the very curious things about Virginia Johnson in real life and certainly in our show is she's an unusual woman in that she can completely separate sex and love. So the idea of having sex with someone doesn't at all need to necessarily come with romantic feelings. And so one of the things we're exploring next season is, what is that really about? What is actually under that story, that story is too reductive and I don't buy it. I just think there's so much evidence to the contrary, which was that it was a much more complicated thing, and that there were the thing that bound them was so strange and so much more interesting than sort of just a typical romance.
For more On Story, check your local PBS station for our television show of the same name. On Story gives you an inside look at the creative process from today's leading writers and directors. From Vince Gilligan discussing his show Breaking Bad, to John Singleton describing the creation of Boys in the Hood. Every episode is a surprising and intimate look at filmmaking. Season 6 of On Story premieres in spring 2016, and all of our episodes are available online. Check your local listings, stream from PBS, or go to onstory.tv. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. Novelist, screenwriter, film director, and producer Caroline Thompson is credited with the screenplays for the films Edward Scissorhands, The Nightmare Before Christmas, and The Addams Family, as well as adaptations of The Secret Garden and Black Beauty, which she also directed. Caroline Thompson's other credits include the films Homeward Bound, The Incredible Journey, and Snow White, The Fairest of Them All.
The following segment includes panels recorded in 2011 and 2015 at the 19th and 22nd Austin Film Festivals.
I don't know if anybody here has ever heard of Teresa of Avila, but there's a beautiful story about her, and it's her definition of faith, but for me it's my definition of the creative process, which is to say she used this beautiful garden metaphor, and the garden is in a desert. So to bring water to the garden, the first step is you grab water out of the river, no matter how far away it is, and you haul it with great difficulty to your plants, and you pour it on the plants, and that's how you water your garden. Step two is you go, wait, I don't think I have to put quite this much effort into it. So you dig a well near the garden. You have a windlass or whatever it's called, and you haul up the water, and you tote it to the garden, and you water your plants that way. And they go like, wait a minute, I'm still working too hard here. And then you dig a canal next to your plants, and somehow you create this thing where you get the water from the well, and you pour it in the canal, and the plants are watered. And again, that still requires effort, and the next phase is that it rains. And I have been blessed with, every now and then, getting to rain. I had an internship at the Los Angeles Times Washington Bureau, and because they weren't a member of a union, so they could hire, or they could have an unpaid employee, and it was during Watergate. Yeah, which you'd think was like the most exciting time in the world to be a journalist, which I'm sure it was, but I couldn't have been less interested. I'd be in the corner writing poetry or whatnot. But it was a really fascinating experience. In the summers, I would work there, and I would take over each person's job as they went on holiday. So one week, I was White House correspondent. Another week, I was Pentagon. Another week, I was the office manager, and that week we were redecorating, and the man whose job it was to do the redecoration was in Los Angeles, and he wasn't doing his job, so when the painter arrived and said, what color shall I paint the office, I said, black. This is how I learned to be clever in Hollywood. You say things they don't want to hear, and then he was like, whoa, 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 and lo and behold, the man whose job it was appeared on the next plane. So I was often working in the library. It was a great experience, but it was not me. My dream was to be a novelist. I moved to LA from the East Coast, quite honestly, to get as far away from my family as I could and stay on the continent. So it was not a desire to be in the movie business, particularly. I believe that my work was completely willed at first. So I was so anxious about writing this book that I had a kind of narcolepsy. So I'd go to the desk, I'd write for a while, and then I'd get so sleepy because I was so anxious. I would literally sleep for 3 hours, and then I would look up and write maybe a few more lines and then go home. I mean, it was grueling, but I had to put myself through it. I wasn't going to let myself not have the dream I had. I had read something Stephen King had written about his editor, this guy called Bill Thompson, no relation, but same name. And so I thought, oh, that's who I want to send it to. And I didn't have an agent. I was 24, whatever, living in LA, but I only moved to LA to get as far away from my family as I could and stay on the continent. So I had a friend pretend to be my agent. So she sent it to Bill Thompson, and it arrived over the transom, as they call it, which means unsolicited, on a Monday. He happened to have a free day, read it that afternoon, and bought it on the Tuesday morning, which was like unbelievable. But sometimes stuff happens, you know? It's really the precursor to Edward Scissorhands. It's this sort of the underbelly. It was a dream come true to write a book, and it's a pretty good book.
I was lucky enough to have a director want to make that novel into a film. That director was Penelope Spheris, and she'd done this kick-ass documentary, if you haven't seen it, called The Decline of Western Civilization. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just brilliant. And I said to her, you can have an option on the book for $1 if I can write the screenplay with you, because she was also a writer. So we did that, and I was smart enough to be the one with my hands on the keys so I could control what actually went there. And I had my Osborne computer with a screen this big and a monitor. It was crazy. And it weighed 40 pounds. It was like a sewing machine. And I took it to her house in Laurel Canyon. She was a great cook, so she cooked lunch. I had my hands on the keys, and we spent every day together adapting my book, which got optioned by John Solomon. Didn't get made into a film, but I did get an agent who was Penelope's agent, John Burnham. He's my agent to this day. It's the longest relationship of my life. has all the ups and downs of any long relationship, which has been fun. They had another client at the agency who was named Tim Burton, and he had just made Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
And they didn't know what to do with either of us, so they figured, well, let them meet. So we met, we had lunch, we became really good friends. He was just the kindest, sweetest, most shy, lovely person, and we knew we wanted to work together, so he, in spitballing, we were all these ideas, he told me about a drawing he had made in high school of a character who had scissors for hands, and I was like, stop right there. That is the stupidest thing I ever heard. It is brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. The metaphor is so clean, so clear, so simple, so straightforward, but has just impossible ramifications because we all feel like that. We all feel, A, we don't know what to do with our hands, and Tim, as you know, you know, this is Tim talking.
On Story is part of a growing number of programs in Austin Film Festival's On Story project, including the On Story PBS series, the On Story radio program and podcast, and the On Story book series. To find out more about On Story and Austin Film Festival, visit onstory.tv or austinfilmfestival.com. Back to screenwriter Caroline Thompson describing the development of the Tim Burton classic, Edward Scissorhands.
Edward Scissorhands was the characterization was based on my beloved dog. The dog upon whom Edward was based was named Ariel, and she was my first dog that was my own dog. And she was a really soulful creature, and she had the most amazing eyes you've ever looked into, and she was so bright and so present. It was almost, I mean, if she had the proper anatomy, she would have been able to talk, but she didn't, so she couldn't. So she was always just there and wanting to participate, wanting to be part of things, and wanting to belong, and wanting to understand how things worked. And that is Edward Scissorhands to me all over. I grew up in a very eccentric architectural and citizen-wise neighborhood. They were all old people. And my best friend at the time when I was in sixth grade lived in this new community of houses that a development where all the houses were exactly the same. And life was lived completely on the street. And I had the most incredible neighborhood envy you could imagine. So this kind of horrific place was the most beautiful place in the world to me at a point in my life. Mm-hmm. And I think that one thing that's really important about being a writer is sort of remembering what things felt like at really, really key moments in your life so that you, it's sort of like I'm writing for a different part of myself than lives today. I don't know if you guys have that experience, but I'm, you know, like in the example of Edward Scissorhands, I was writing for my 12 to 14 year old self. Mm-hmm. And I also love Frankenstein. My novel was a kind of really dark suburban Frankenstein story. And I think of Edward as a very similar tale, but it's the brighter mm-hmm. one, if you can imagine such a thing. Our original intention, our original belief was that this was so odd that maybe if we made it as a musical, people could accept it. So in addition to writing the prose version, I wrote these really terrible lyrics. And, you know, like, you know, I can't handle it, things like that, you know. But anyway, maybe it was reading the lyrics that made Tim go, we don't need to do a musical. But I think that I'm proud to say that the story was so, I mean, it never changed from that prose version. It was just, I'm just telling you, it was like it rained through my head. It was just, I don't know, sometimes it's like that. Mm-hmm. And those are the blessed ones. And this one was, there's so many things blessed about that movie. It was, I think Tim was really happy for me to be writing for him because I didn't know the movies, as I told you. I was not a movie person. I didn't have, like, first, second, third act, you know, turn on page 24. I mean, all the formula was not, it had a rhythm in me, but I didn't have a sense of formula. And so I could bring something to it that was coming from someplace else, and it worked. It's like, you know, I didn't get a single note from Tim Burton because he was very inarticulate at that time. That was the best. We were just in lockstep without having to talk. We spoke each other's unspoken language. Scott Rudin, who was the head of Fox when we did Edward, was the one who gave us the deal, and it was the sweetest deal of all time. The movie, it was a miracle it got made. It would never be made today. And the miracle was that Scott recognized Tim's talent, would have signed up to do the phone book with him, basically. Tim had only done No, he didn't even. I think he was shooting Beetlejuice. But anyway, Scott is a smart man, and he recognized Tim's talent. And they made a and the deal was, they would pay me scale, and we would have no studio meetings, no studio notes. We would give them the script, and they had a weekend in which to decide whether to give it a green light or turn around, and that was it. Period. It's unimaginable, even then, but particularly today, but totally unimaginable. But believe me, that story, you know, there's, I told this the last panel I was on, where Tom Cruise wanted to play the part at one point, but we could never, to his satisfaction, answer the question of how Edward Scissorhands went to the bathroom. And so we ended up going in another direction. But, you know, that kind of logic is irrelevant in the context of a fable. But that's the kind of thing that would, you know, would drive a studio executive mad that we couldn't answer that question. So the thing about Edward Scissorhands, and I hope every single person in this room gets to have a perfect experience of some sort in their life. And it was my first, so I didn't realize how rare it was. But every single person on that movie was the right person to be on that movie. So the costumes were perfect. The music was perfect. The set design was perfect. The director was perfect. I was the right writer for it. That Johnny and Winona and all the actors were the right actors for it. I mean, it just, we were all ready to, because I don't know if you've had this experience, but even when you're the director, it's hard to get everybody making the same movie. And in that case, everybody was making the very same movie. And it was a very strange movie to be, you know, to get that tone right, to get the sensibility right. It was just a complete and utter dream. The first preview of that movie was the most intense and amazing experience of my life until Johnny Depp gave me a prize yesterday. Which is to say, I mean, when we were terrified, because every kid going to that audience looked like the character of Jim from the movie, the bad kid. So Tim was in the bathroom puking. I went to watch the movie, and they all laughed. They laughed exactly where I thought they would laugh. They laughed. And I didn't have the understanding of taking a tape recorder and all this. I had the chills. They were laughing. They were laughing. And then it turned, and they started to, I heard this like, and then I heard like, I'm sitting back there just like, my face hurts so bad. I'm smiling so big because it worked. Anyway. I mean, I remember Joe Roth. He was the head of Fox at that time. Anyway, he was married to this lovely woman called Donna Roth. And she came up to the producer who she knew, I was standing next to, and said, at least you've got one. After the screening of Edward Scissorhands, you know, you'll always have this one. You'll always have one. And she's right. And that's like such a blessing.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Klaberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. Generous support is also provided by the City of Austin Cultural Arts Division, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, the Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Our executive producer is Barbara Morgan, and the show is produced and edited by myself, Brian Ramos. I do the music for the show as well. Our associate producers are Aaron Halligan, Sonia Onescu, and Maya Perez. Our production coordinator is Katie Stewart, editing help from Jamal Knox. Production assistance from KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and conference in October. Until next time, I'm Brian Ramos, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.
PRI, Public Radio International.